Welcome back to another episode of Church Hurts. And the good, the bad, and the ugly about church today. We look at religion, spirituality with a dash of recovery thrown in. So if you've ever had questions like so many of us about the church today, place of religion, and where we're all headed with our own spirituality, well, maybe you've come to the right place. Our host, well, he was an honors philosophy student, ordained a Presbyterian minister, and he planted three churches along the way. He also taught at a prestigious university and was a teaching pastor at one of the megachurches here in Southern California. He even served as an executive coach for a while, but now he likes to think of himself as just an aging curmudgeon who never quite ceases to ask the one question on all our minds, no matter what the topic. Why? Why not bring him in and get started here? The host of Church Hurts and Dr. John Bash. Welcome, sir.
I watched a humorous video the other day which showed a horse race with a mock announcer calling out the silly horse names they had made up for this. And it was all about the virus we're calling Corona. Shelter in place is rounding the curve, followed by daily briefings. Here comes Dr. Fauci. You get the point. It was hard not to laugh, but one got weary of the point being made almost until they stuck around for the ending. And then, to paraphrase it so it will be proper for radio, they said, "And coming from nowhere to take the race is who the heck knows?" By ahead. Confusion. Surely we're in that today in the middle of this virus. And even when people listen to this show at another time, the kind of things that can cause us confusion, they don't seem to stop. What's the best thing for the country to do right now? How can we stand together? What's the national government supposed to do? What should states do? What should local officials do? Laws and rules vary from expert to expert, medical minds intersecting with legal minds, and politicians never stopping with opinions. And then it all gets personal, like it always does. What do you do? And we talk about the church here. What should the church do? Really, we're all asking, how do we find clarity in the midst of this? So today, we have a guest who is uniquely qualified to help us navigate this subject because he's faced a lot of confusion in his life. Currently, he's the CFO at EFCON Laboratories, which means he plays around in the middle of clinical trials with money. Now, doesn't that sound fun? Back in the days of the biotech boom, he was with Genentech, and in between, he even worked with churches a lot. His life has produced results so that lots of people seek his advice on lots of things. So let's find out why. From Atlanta, let me bring on J. Kent Berklow. Welcome to Church Hurts, and Kent.
John, thanks for that gracious introduction. It's terrific to be with you today and to all of your many followers. I do. Certainly, you make a very good point about this being a time of mass confusion. And unfortunately, we have a whole eclectic group. And in my background being clinical pharmacology, I look at things probably a little differently than the average person, even though my subspecialty is infectious disease. Doesn't tell me how to take care of viruses. They're a whole different animal. So I'm not sure of that. I can really speak very much, but it certainly is a confusing time. There are many pundits who have a variety of things that they think are the right way to go. And unfortunately, I'm afraid many of them are not qualified enough to make those assumptions and assertions.
Well, we might push you a little bit on that, but we've heard so many people's opinions about it and are so tired of trying to sort through who's right. Now, I don't even want to talk to anybody about it, to be honest. It's because everybody has an opinion, whether they have any qualification to speak on the subject or not. But, Kent, I want to go to a place that I kind of apologize for it, because my guess is you really kind of don't even want to talk about it, but a time in your life when something happened to you, you were on a Mediterranean cruise with your wife trying to enjoy life, because I don't know why you work so much. I mean, you have a foundation that gives away money. You're a successful man in so many ways, but you work and you work and work when you're on a cruise and you're relaxing, and they have to get through to that ship to get to you to tell you what.
On our first morning at being at sea, I got a phone call from my son, and he informed me that his younger brother, our youngest son, had been, because he had recently moved in the previous 6 months or so to Fort Collins, Colorado. It was just an incredible outdoorsman. Had done the Appalachian Trail in 99 days, which is 2,470 miles. Just an incredible outdoors kid. The morning he worked in a pharmacy there in Fort Collins, and the morning of the event, he was climbing what they call one of the 14ers, made it all the way to the top, was on his way back down, and even though it was June, there was 6 to 8 inches of snow all on the ground, so many of the trail markings were uncovered, and as he got to what's called the keyhole on the way back, he got into an 80-knot wind event with freezing rain, and was just blown off, and we found out that he was missing, and it was several days before they were able to find and recover his body. And you can only well imagine, both my wife and I have very, very small families, and I'm adopted, so I have a very limited family as well. And to certainly lose one of your two blood relatives hit us as a family extremely hard, extremely hard.
You know, Kent, you were one of those people who reached out to me when my son became paralyzed, and one of the few people I could listen to because I knew you understood it. But what you went through was very different than me, because I had my son. He just had a body that sucked. The confusion for you, as you said, without much family, being adopted yourself and yet having established such a wonderful family, that had to be terribly confusing. What went through your head? How did you get through it?
Boy, that's the imperative question I would surmise. Clearly, we were in immediate shock, as you might expect, and we were, for many people who say there are five phases of suffering and grief, I would tell you that just to get through the first two are probably the hardest, and we ended up in that phase that's the numbness, if you will. And that was impending for a pretty long time. But very clearly, one of the most important things that happened immediately was we fell on our knees in prayer, and just really relished in the fact that we knew God loved us in spite of the fact that we didn't understand this. But we knew that his life had served a purpose, and we relished that we had 25 wonderful years with him.
You know, here we talk about the fact that the church can really be hurtful and miss the point sometimes. But sometimes we confuse our problems with the church and our problems with God. You know, isn't it that some people just have a problem with God at this point? Forget the church. Come on, God. Really? My son, or my, well, not my son, my dad was an alcoholic, and he was a loving, loving man, but he still was a drunk. And I remember as I got to know him as just a young adult, because he died when I was only 22, but talking to him about what it was like, he lost a child, the first child. And he insensitively said, yeah, you wouldn't be here if we hadn't. I'm like, oh, thanks, Dad. That makes me feel meaningful. But when he would talk about that, you know, really, what is God doing when it comes to life and death? That's really what we're talking about. Is it really okay that God chooses when we live and when we die, right? I mean, isn't this a God issue more than a church issue?
Wow, that's a really important question as well. I think you are exactly right. I think it's much more about the understanding of the relationship that each of us should have with God. I think one of the things that was most comforting to us was in the passage of Isaiah 57. It really begins with verse 1. and speaks to the fact that, and just to paraphrase from a couple of different translations, it in essence says this: sometimes the righteous or the young are taken before their time. It is because God has seen calamity in their path that he's chosen to spare them of. Powerful, powerful. We can't understand God's will. We can't understand his pathways. We just have to trust that he is omniscient. He does know all. And we just have to trust him that our life is part of his bigger plan. Sometimes that is hard for us to appreciate and understand. And yet we look at the blessings of the things we've not had to suffer through. Our generation has not had to suffer through, in essence, a major world war, as our parents did, or you know, even some grandparents did. So we've been blessed in other ways that we just tend to take so for granted. So hope that's pointed to the question you really ask.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just thinking, though, you know, you mentioned being adopted. You know, you had to start out at a pretty young age processing some of these big issues. At the core of who we are, I think adopted kids got to go through stuff that just the rest of us don't, right?
Oh, yeah, no question. And even, you know, as a young age, when other kids use it as a point of teasing you, you know, just in that in and of itself. But fortunately, my parents, even though I didn't have them forever or for very long, really, they were my parents and, you know, never missed a beat in making sure that we knew we were loved. And, you know, that's all that really matters.
You know, I lost my mother when I just turned 3. And so I just hear stories. I really don't have any memories of her, but it's something that people hear that and anybody can have empathy thinking of me as a little 3-year-old losing a mother. What could be more traumatic? I used to say I'm perfect fodder for a psychology 101 classroom of why is this man a criminal and in jail? So I have set my standards very low and that makes life a little bit easier. But in reality, I've made up stories of who, what a wonderful, perfect woman and mother this must have been who loved me fully because I never knew her. So, and yet at the same time, I had all the consequences of that. And those things play with us into adulthood, even to old age like me. I know you're not as old as I am, but you might even have a few years on me, but you don't have to tell. But I want to go back. So you, here you are. You've been adopted, you're moving on. You really have kind of an impressive career. And some people, when they heard that Genentech thing in my introduction, I think there's some people who want to say, okay, you guys are off into really heavy, dramatic stuff. Can you just tell us for a minute, talk about confusion. You were at Genentech in the middle of the biotech boom, right? Confusion.
Yeah, I was on the ground floor, if you will, 40th person in the door. And in essence, you know, we were the darling of Wall Street, and yet we were the goats on the other side. People didn't understand the science, and it was a very telling time. You know, we were navigating through trying to teach FDA on what biotechnology even was. That's how early it was. And we learned that you couldn't patent a protein from the U.S. Bureau of Biologics. So, you know, here you spent a couple of $1 billion getting a product and can't even get a patent on it. So it was a pretty tenuous time in the business, and I can tell you it was very tumultuous from a whole lot of different perspectives. And you can well imagine the old guards of the places I came from, Merck and some others, they really did think we were, you know, we were the heretics of the business because we weren't doing chemical synthesis. We were cloning protein, and they thought we were a bunch of lunatics. But sure, they were too far from wrong, but just created a whole new science. And Genentech, of course, is the only company ever awarded a patent for the process. They did not discover the science, they invented the science, and which makes it a very unique trial. And of course, they were very open with their patents, so that's why you see so many other biotech companies today. But it was a very amazing time, and you know, certainly a time that I appreciate looking back on my career as one of the milestones.
But now that you've totally gone over all of our heads, I'm gonna have to push it a little bit. So okay. when you watch, wait, do you have any uniquely funny stories from that Genentech time?
Oh yeah, how long do you have? It was really an amazing trek because this was a senior management group that had gone out and hired what they believed were the very best in the business and just got out of the way. I mean, they were just so completely averse to any sort of a management style that whatever you did was fine. We used to have a statement that anything we ever did that basically was unaccepted in another company, it was automatically accepted there. I mean, even to the extent that there was a beer tap in the company cafeteria, if you can imagine that several years later. I mean, it was just open forum to whatever you want to do. I'm not sure that you take that many professionals and experts and scientists and cloners and whatever else, and you turn them loose without any guidance. I'm not sure that's the right way to do things, and they paid some pretty heavy prices for it. But ultimately, the jobs got done.
So, Desmond, when you're watching TV today, it must look really different to you than it does to the rest of us amateurs who aren't scientists. And you're seeing, I am sitting there just amazed at the amount of babbling noise I'm hearing. It seems to me that horse race thing I talked about is really ends up describing it. I mean, all these people with views, and then they end up being wrong, and then they end up changing their mind. And people don't know whether to wear a mask, not to wear a mask, whether to be with their family who they don't live with. I started out, and they said, this is not the time to go see your grandkids. I'm like, really? I have my first natural. I have a couple grandsons from my foster son, but I had my first natural grandchild 2 months old, and they're saying, no, this is not the time to be selfish and go see your grandchild. I'm like, I don't like this. And yet others I look at get together as families as if somehow being a family makes them immune from the virus. It's like, no, it's whether or not you're living in the same household. How are you seeing this?
I think, unfortunately, we've allowed those who are not learned and are not experienced and do not pose the credentials of really understanding what this is all about, make political decisions that, unfortunately, have impacted dramatically the way we've reacted to this. I'm not saying it was wrong, but I'm simply saying that, the first thing you do before you go fly an airplane is you learn how to fly it. And we've got people who are trying to fly the airplane who probably the first time you've ever been on one. And that to me is a little bit disheartening. We've tended to not listen to the people who are truly in the best position to give us the right answers. And we've ignored them. And to me, that's a little bit disheartening. I never would have thought I would have seen science take such a backseat to things that really are science driven.
It's interesting you say it because I feel like it goes both ways. I feel like we have people in science being asked to make political decisions and people in political positions being asked to make scientific decisions or decisions based on science. It's just confusing.
Well, I would tell you the people that we consider to be scientists, many of them are public health driven, and public health is an entirely different animal than a pure research scientist. And we've listened way too much to the public health arena and not listened to the true scientists. That's the delineation for me. Oh,
gotcha. Now, I also, and I don't know how in the world did you go from that world to working in churches, helping churches raise money for big, significant, there had to be something. Most businessmen or scientists don't switch gears and go and say, I'm going to help this church raise money, because money is one of the things that bothers people most about churches. What happened in your life that you decided to do that?
You know, there's a story in the Bible about Saul becoming Paul. That's my journey, I think. Of course, my own church, home church here in the Atlanta area, went through a capital campaign. We were a very young church, only 4 years old with 400 members, and we embarked upon a $6 million family life building. I was asked to chair that committee, which I did, and then it became part of the stewardship team. And we hired some outside consultants to help us model, if you will, the stewardship education component, which some people would call fundraising. I would call it anything but fundraising. We used to refer to it, as you know, as faith raising. But I got involved in that process, and it became very clear to me as we navigated through what this faith community was doing, that God had been setting aside all the things that he taught me through the years, the management, the negotiations, all the other things I learned. He was putting all of those together in a package, preparing me for the time that I would become an independent contractor working up in churches, and did that for about 13 years before I formed my own firm. And only in the last 5 years after we lost our son, did I get to the place where I knew I could no longer travel. And so obviously I've gone back into the business, but the reality was it was for me an answer to calling of something that I would have never dreamed in a million years I would have done. Just being obedient and just understanding that God was having me step out, walking away from a job back in the 90s, making $300,000 to a job where you don't know if you're going to have the next month's income. And it changes. You talk about faith, let me tell you, you find real quickly that your faith is tested every day in that business in a lot of ways, and spiritual assaults to boot.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah. And Kent, you know, you're obviously a very spiritual and godly man. So let me just say it. You must, in working with all the churches you did found and all the church boards you interacted with, those must have just been really spiritually minded, well put together, wise church boards that did. Were just really encouraging to you. They would never make stupid decisions. It wasn't like in the secular world where people would get off track. Right? I mean, church boards are really helpful all the time, aren't they?
Colin, you're a lot smarter man than that. You've been through this and you know what I'm going to say. Stunningly enough, I would tell you it's probably just the opposite of that. I'm not sure why it is, and there are, don't get me wrong, there are godly people who care and love about their church and care and love about their pastor or their reverend, but there are people who have navigated themselves and positioned themselves into positions on boards, if you will, that it's the only thing in their life they've ever done that has the appearance of success. They have very little qualification. Some of them come with a, you know, bee in their bonnet, if you will. And I would just tell you that that number is probably half and half. I think there's some really good people there, but I think there are a lot of people who feel like if they are serving, that's the same thing as being obedient, and they're just not the same thing.
Interesting. You know, I come at it from the opposite point of view. I see, I've seen what you're talking about, but I see some really intelligent, qualified, successful people because they're successful in the world who then get elected to a church board. And I often say, I think there's a guillotine set up before the boardroom because they have to have their heads chopped off before they go in, because there's no way people this intelligent could make those decisions.
Oh, that's, I couldn't have said it better myself. It's like they check their brain at the door when they walk in. Very capable, very qualified, but they feel like because they're in the presence of other godly people or godly staff person that they have to bow down and do what that person wants or says they should do. And, you know, the whole purpose of being a capable, qualified professional means you should use those skills to the benefit of the church and not your credentials to just be a yes person.
So the person listening and saying, yeah, my board does stupid things, and I've seen that, and that's frustrated me. That's why I don't go to church. What do you say?
Oh, boy. Here we go. You know, I would just have to say to that person, you're really putting things that should not be in your filter in the place of interfering with what God may have in store for you. Just if you really feel that strongly about it, you need to go to a church where you don't feel obligated to do anything. We just come worship for a while, get your feet on the ground, get back in the word, get back in the vine, get back in whatever it is you need to be back in. And God will open the doors of when he's ready for you to be in service. If you take that kind of an attitude in, you're not going to be of much service at all. In fact, you're going to be an impediment.
You know, Kent, time has kind of flown. We've jumped around like crazy, and that's confusing. Shouldn't a show on confusion be confusing? And underneath it, I'd like you to tell us a story that kind of can give us hope, because in the midst of it, and I was even say with that, you know, with what you just said, I really appreciate that. You know, there's times to step back and not get so wound up and be into things where you just say, no, it's okay. I'm going to kind of, a lot of times I don't know why the leaders are making certain decisions, and I really don't have the energy to want to know. Sometimes decisions were made which I thought were really wrong. The guy I think of when you were telling your story about Genentech and biotech, I was thinking of Steve Jobs and where he got so many of his idea at, you'll know the lab name, I forget, where he basically got the object theory for his Mac, that was Labs. Anyway, but I would look at Jobs making decisions and say, why is he doing that? That's stupid. That's not going to work. You know, and one after another, I was wrong. You know, fortunately, I wasn't in the boardroom helping make those decisions, right? It's, we don't have to know it all. But underneath it, Kent, give us some hope. Give us some hope. You've had to navigate some waters.
I think one of the things I would tell you is that when we see, certainly in the lives that we spend working in the life of the church, when we see individual families changed by the simple understanding that never is it ever about money. It's because God has all the money. He has everything. I mean, the reality is, do we think his net worth went up or down one penny through this last debacle and the exchanges that have taken place? But of course not. What he wants is our heart. He wants us to give of ourselves to the point that we don't challenge every time he gives us something that's his course and mission. And that's for us sometimes as Christians, you know, we think we know better. You know, we think we've got it all figured out because we use worldly comparisons to basically guide our decisions. When many times, as you talk about the decisions in the boardroom, certainly I don't pretend to have all the answers. And I'm very quick to make that point. But I do believe that God has a purpose for us. He wants us to be in his love and in his fold, and he wants us to give our hearts to him. And when we do that, I think we get to the place where we really fully understand that life is imperfect and the people around us are imperfect. Churches are imperfect. But the beautiful part about his love and relationship is he doesn't care about any of that. All he cares about is us as individuals and how we love him as individuals. When we do that, we become more whole as Christians. Hopefully that helps.
Well, Kent, you know, you're imperfect in a lot of ways, and I love reminding you of that.
I know you do.
But I know when I needed somebody, you were there. And it wasn't that you were perfect. It's that you were there and that you cared. And I think sometimes the and in church and is in they care, but they're imperfect. Yeah. And, you know, I celebrated a very significant anniversary this past week that I want to mention as I wrap up. I'm not actually going to tell you what that anniversary was for, but it was wonderful. More people took time to celebrate it with me than I ever could have expected. A Zoom call included people from all over the country. Someone brought me the most beautiful gift bag filled with food that I've ever seen. They even knew me so well and included giant scallops. One person called me from halfway around the world. The following day, do you know what I thought about? The one person I had most looked forward to congratulating me had never shown up or even sent a message. I tried not to dwell on it, but I failed. And then a friend told me he thought the celebration wasn't done quite right and I hadn't handled it well. I tried not to dwell on that, and I failed. It seems to me that as creatures walking around in this world, we have an amazing ability to miss the point in the midst of confusion. We get confused easily, and sometimes we don't help each other very well, do we? I'm reminded of a man who was in quarantine in his rented house in Rome almost 2,000 years ago. Actually, he was under house arrest, but it was for 2 years and he wasn't allowed to go out to the store. Some friends of his in another country sent him a big present and he wrote to thank them. And these are his words. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition with thanksgiving, present your request to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Finally, he says, brothers and sisters, whatever's true, whatever's noble, whatever's right, whatever's pure, whatever's lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things. That was the Apostle Paul. And it's worth a thought.
And that brings us to the end of another episode of Church Hurts, and leaving us as always with a lot to think about. If you'd like to share your thoughts or continue the conversation with our host, Dr. John Bash, he's a shepherd with Standing Stone, a nonprofit ministry committed to caring for pastors and Christian leaders at risk of leaving the ministry prematurely. You can find out more about their work and all that they do at Church Hurts by come visiting churchhurtsand.org. And next week, yes, there's always a next week, we have a very special guest ready to tackle the easy subject of churches in the Middle East. Don't miss that one.